Here are the numbers now. Wind west at 5, humidity 81%, 74 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Well, it's not all that often that we hear stories of maternal abandonment, but there certainly are instances when it happens, when a mother, for whatever reason or reasons, walks out on her family. And the mother of my morning show guest, Diane Danvers Simmons, did exactly that. But the fact that her mother ended up moving into the house next door and with some handsome young college students is just one way in which this story is quite uncommon. And it is very well told in my guest's memoir titled My Mother Next Door. Diane Danvers Simmons has enjoyed great success in marketing and advertising, and then essentially left most of that behind to become a mother. She actually created a podcast called Mothers and Daughters Unfiltered that I've not yet had a chance to hear, but I'm anxious to check that out. But in the meantime, I'm excited to talk with her about this book. We should mention Diane Danvers Simmons is British-born, now living in America, having moved here when she was in her late 20s. And as she tells us, when America beckoned, it was an exit. It was my fresh start to become the life I wanted, to create the life I wanted. And this book is published by Kohler, again titled My Mother Next Door. And Diane Danvers Simmons, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. Good morning. It's lovely to speak to you.
I'm really, really excited about this. I want to mention that the book has two dedications, the second of which is to Diana Ross. Explain to our listeners.
That is correct.
Explain to our listeners why Diana Ross is the second dedicatee of your book.
I certainly will. It's quite interesting, actually. As you know, after reading my book, I dedicated every chapter title to Diana Ross, a Diana Ross song. And the reason being, I was growing up as a, you know, teenager, teeny bopper in the 70s, and my idol was Diana Ross. And so I used to, you know, get the hairbrush out with my best friend Hazel and sing Diana Ross songs all the time. And it was really her music that helped me get through this very tough time. And so I thought, you know what? I think I need to do a second dedication to her for the book.
Well, as someone who is a big Diana,
music's a great healer.
Absolutely. As someone who is a big Diana Ross and the Supremes fan, my eyes lit up when I started to see those chapter titles. So I think that's a terrific idea.
Thank you.
You tell us,
and there's even a playlist at the back of the book.
So very good.
You can put your own playlist together.
You tell us early in the book that it took a long time for this book to take shape. How long are we talking, and why did it take so long?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think I say in my introduction. I know I say in my introduction actually that this truly is the story I never intended to tell. It's a very personal story, but I was doing a lot of keynote speeches, empowerment speeches for young women, and, you know, people have their different issues. And I would begin to say, you know, we all have a story. We all have a story that begins with our mother. And, you know, there are magical moments there. There are painful moments there. There are things that we see we need to change. Somehow, sorry about that. I lost my earbud. It would always seem to help people. The first reaction every time I would tell the story, or just say the first line, you know, a week after my 16th birthday, my mother basically told me she was done. And she left and she moved next door to move to live with three hot college students. But it was interesting how people would laugh. And then they would look at me and they say, would ask me, well, how did you make that through? How did you get through that? And so we would have that discussion. I realized that the story, which I started off writing as a very funny story, because it is funny at the end of the day, and humor is something that helps us get through, again, painful times, painful memories. But I would see how it would help people. And so I thought, well, maybe there's a good reason to write this. And the other reason is when my mother left, I vowed I would never do that to my children, to my daughter. And so I have this very strong bond with my daughter and relationship. And I've always worked very hard to make sure that I listen to my children and I consider children, my actions and how they do impact my children. It doesn't mean I'm not going to live my life, but it means I'm going to be very sensitive to their needs as well and the bigger picture, which is this amazing family I have. And it was really a trip to Morocco where she had just completed her first year of college and she was going through a really hard time. And I was very conscious that I needed to take her somewhere and be somewhere with her where we could re-cement our relationship. And it was really on that trip where I met this woman who was a channeler of all things. After a dinner, it was the most bizarre situation. I have to write this book because it's actually hysterical, all the stories that came along with it. And she said to me, you need to forgive your mother. And you need to forgive your mother because if you don't, it will impact your daughter and future generations. And that might sound strange to people, but there were all these messages and instances that were happening around me that kept on saying, you need to write the story, you need to write the story. But it probably took, a lifetime, obviously, but to actually write it, about 5 years, because I kept on walking away from the story.
You say writing this has been the hardest thing I've ever done. And you say what emerged when I began to write was a story of heartbreak and forgiveness, love and hate, madness and sanity, comedy and sadness, sacrifice and self-liberation, defeat and empowerment. Feelings which surprised me as much as they challenged me and enlightened me in more ways than I could ever have imagined. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Diane Danvers Simmons about her memoir called My Mother Next Door. It is first and foremost the story of her, let's say, checkered relationship with her mother, who was obviously a brilliant yet troubled woman in many ways. But it's also the story of her relationship, that is the author's relationship with other members of the family, including her father, and about the ways in which she tried to move forward through all that life threw at her, including this extraordinary experience of being, in a sense, abandoned by her own mother. Chapter one of your book, Diane Danvers Simmons, is titled Love Child. And that's not only because that's a famous Diana Ross and the Supremes hit, but also because it is also saying something about the circumstances under which you were born. Tell our listeners more about that.
Yes, and it's a really important part of the book, actually, which when I started to write the book, I was just going to write the book about when Mum left. However, I think to this point, it's really important to show the history. Because unless you understand someone's story and how, why they did this, you can't find compassion or forgiveness. So my mother was in her mid-40s. You got to remember, my mother was Irish Catholic. So this is quite unusual, and she used to call herself a heathen. She's quite a character. But she met my father, started dating my father, who was 60, a widower. He was 60. They both had teenage children. And, you know, whoopsie, they become pregnant with me. My mother's in her mid-40s, dad's 60, and so they get married. And then they have to blend my mother's two teenage children, age 15 and 18, and my dad's daughter, and a new baby. So it was an unusual circumstance, and I think Love Child says it very well. But that was very unusual for that time.
Right, exactly. You say back then a recently divorced, unmarried woman in her mid-40s who'd just been impregnated by a 60-year-old widower was virtually unheard of. And so, I mean, it's really important for us to understand not only what happened, but when it happened and in the setting in which it happened. Because without that, we don't fully understand kind of the ramifications of it all.
Yeah, this was 1959, you know, so they got married. That's what you did. Mm. And, you know, I say somewhere in the book, I'm really grateful to my parents that they followed through with this. I mean, you can't imagine you're a man, but any woman can imagine. Even now, having a woman, having a baby at 45, that's tough. You know, that's hard. So, and pulling together a teenage family, there's a lot of hormones flying around. There's a lot of emotion flying around at
right.
that time.
We get something, we get a good sense of kind of how your mother was wired, and in particular, the sort of unbridled way in which she tended to communicate with you and others. When you quote her as saying this to you, as she used to say, with all the lack of sensitivity of the time, your mother said to you, "I knew you'd either have Down syndrome or you'd be bloody brilliant." You go on to say...
Yeah.
And you go on to say, appalling as it sounds, I like to think that in her own way, she was saying she would have loved me no matter what. And I find that such an interesting example, and it's not the last time in the book that you are, in a sense, having to take these rather shocking things your mother was inclined to say, and I don't know what the word is, putting the most positive spin on them, or trying to understand where they were coming from. But, I mean, not everybody takes the time to try to do that.
I think it's very important to do that. I always say, I would never change a thing. I'm very grateful I grew up with my mother, because she really toughened me up for this world. And what she did is she allowed me to look at this world with my eyes without any judgment. Because I could tell from her mannerisms, from her energy, that she wasn't saying it to be mean to me, even though she did have a forked tongue and could really cut people in two with her words. But she'd grown up in an incredibly tough time. And, you know, she'd come to England on her own when she was 16. So there was this cutting humor that was laced in a lot of conversation. And I think when you grow up with that as a kid, or kids are more innocent, they're more accepting of people. And if you can somehow keep that essence, it's amazing what you can get through, and it's amazing how you can overcome what others would see as very hurtful words and discussions, you can work your way through them. I mean, it doesn't mean it doesn't hurt sometimes or you find it a little jarring, but you can see your way through it.
In chapter two, You Can't Hurry Love, you write these intriguing words. If I were writing a fairy tale, I would describe my upbringing as a magical adventure and treacherous trial, complete with witches and villains and kings and queens who could welcome or banish you with the wave of a wand. Tell us more about why this is a fairly accurate way to characterize at least much of your childhood.
I think because the foundation of my childhood was I had these two very interesting older parents who, you know, my father was old enough to be my grandfather. And there were all these stories. They were storytellers. I was always hearing these amazing stories about, from my mother, how she grew up on the rolling green hills of Ireland and the fairies and the leprechauns. And then from my father about, you know, all the stories of when he was in the war or Europe or creating these businesses. So they were all, and their families, they were these big families that all that were all these characters that were all larger than life characters. It was really interesting. When you speak to my cousin Mike and I, we always say we had the most interesting and colorful of childhood. But it was very grounded in this love and family came first, even though everyone was always having a big blowout, not speaking to each other for a while. Mother would suddenly do something crazy, and in fact, she used to call herself an old witch because she would see things or she would see something that was going to happen the next day. Or so there was always all this magical stuff and then crazy stuff going on around me. But somehow, there was this solid love and this family that didn't really matter how many times they fell out or weren't speaking to each other, would somewhere along the line manage to patch it up. Hmm. So it was. It was a bit like, a fairy tale half the time. And we lived in this big old house that my mother used to say was haunted. It opens your eyes to the world and the different personalities that inhabit it, and that we're really not all the same. And someone can come across in some manner, but there's always a story behind it. There's always a reason behind it.
Sure. When you're 5 years old, your father essentially retires and moves all of you to the suburbs. And you really explore what a devastating blow this was for your mother in the third chapter of the book, fittingly titled Lady Sings the Blues. you write, "Mum was miserable, suddenly plucked from her network of friends, family, even storekeepers, and the world she knew. Now she was lost, literally and figuratively." Tell us more about just how difficult this was and the way in which this was almost certainly connected to this dramatic abandonment of you that was going to occur a few years later.
Yes, my mother was a very social person. She loved to tell a story, be the center of attention. And she had lived, Bill, ever since she left Ireland, basically, when she was 16. She'd lived in the West London area of Ealing, Shepherd's Bush, Hammersmith, that whole area. And my mother walked or bused everywhere. She never drove a car. And so community and that's something that we're hearing more and more about now. Community is so important to us all, and particularly to her. So she was used to popping into her hairdressers every week. And if she wasn't having her hair done, she could pop by because she lived nearby, popping into a local store, family members nearby. So if you can imagine them being pulled out of that community which has supported you through the war, through the birth of your children, through the loss of your children, through your divorce, you know, there was a market she used to go to all the time. And I remember as a little girl, her on a Wednesday taking me on the bus from Isleworth, where we had moved, the 37 bus, all the way to Shepherd's Bush to go to the market where she would just be in her element again and happy. But she had to really make effort and work to go back to her community and see people. So I think, you know, with a young child in your, by then, you know, she's 50, moving to a new area where you don't know anyone, she was isolated. Mm. It's very, very hard. And you know, I think one of the things as being a mother myself, when I had my children, I, because of my children in the school system, the way it is here versus the way it was when I was growing up, I was able to meet other mothers. I was able to interact. My mother, if you think about it, was the age of a lot of the mothers of their mothers. So she couldn't really relate to any of the mothers even at my school because she was so much older.
Right. So she begins, of course, to really struggle with this more and more, and demonstrates probably symptoms of what we might now think of as perhaps clinical depression or anxiety or whatever. At one point you say, "Dad, he was as dumbfounded as a duck in chicken soup," you know, trying to figure out, you know, what to do, and ultimately sends her to a place called Harley Street, which I think is a place where she receives some kind of care, and you tell us she came back seemingly better. At this point in chapter 4, you say this really interesting thing. I had a mother and a father, two very different people, whom I never referred to as my parents. I never saw them as a unit. I thought that was so interesting. You would talk about your mother, you would talk about your father, but you would never talk about your parents, because you just didn't see them as any kind of a team. You said they coexisted, but otherwise, this in so many ways was not a conventional marriage, nor were they what one would conventionally think of as parents co-parenting you.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, I as you said earlier, all these different emotions, this enlightenment as I was writing this book, because I realized, I tried to understand how I was so intuitive as a child. And I don't say that at all, but when I look back, I really remember vividly never thinking of them as parents, which is unusual, as you point out. And it was mom and dad. And it might have been because when I went round to other friends' houses, I saw how their parents interacted. Now, it doesn't mean that my parents didn't have, you know, they had an agreement on how they raised me, the values they taught me, the discipline. My father was the ultimate word in discipline. You know, they both had the same view of what they hoped for for the trajectory of my life and what they wanted for me. So they're coming together, and their unit, so to speak, was really all about me and my well-being. And that they were totally united. But then they were these two very different independent people. And it is. I find it still really interesting now as I even think back to it and look at it, that as a child, it was mum and dad. Never, ever spoke about them as my parents. Hmm. Never.
And, of course, what also made your situation complicated is the fact that this was a blended family. And
yes.
You had several siblings, a couple of which were half-siblings. And your oldest sister, Marie, was old enough to be your own mother. And I think it's also interesting you tell the story of how your other half-sister, Leslie, your attractive, cool, trendy sister, she was actually, if I understand, allowed to name you. And that was something that your father and her father consciously did as a way to, you know, trying to be sensitive to her as to, you know, her situation changing with your arrival. And it's just a really interesting example of the length that parents will go to in a situation like this to try to make sure that everybody feels like they're part of this rather out of the ordinary family. No small matter.
No, it's very, very true because, you know, Leslie had lost her mother at age 13. And so, you know, my father had been, you know, running the business and raise a 13-year-old daughter. And again, we're talking about in the late 50s, 60s, early 60s, trying to raise a daughter on your own. And my father's, And this is, you know, when we talk about my mother and my mother and father both put their children first, not each other. It was about the children. So, you know, my father was very sensitive to the fact that my sister had this great loss. She suddenly had this new family, this new mother, and this new baby. And so he didn't want her to feel threatened or as if she was going to be pushed aside or she was second. She was still very much his daughter and a daughter that he loved deeply, just as he did I.
Hmm. We're speaking with Diane Danvers Simmons about her memoir, My Mother Next Door. It is in Chapter 5, titled Stop in the Name of Love, that the most dramatic single event in your childhood occurs, and that is the moment when your mother, a week after your 16th birthday, announces that she is leaving your father. And your response was essentially, you threatened that every week. So apparently it was kind of that kind of a volatile situation in the home where this kind of thing would be said from time to time. Of course, this time she was serious. What sorts of signs were there that there was this level of trouble in their marriage and that your mother, in fact, might go ahead and do something as drastic as abandoning you?
Well, I think, I talk about this in the book as well. You know, it wasn't really until my teens, probably 13, 14, that she would, you know, throw out a, you know, I had this life before you. I'm leaving your father. He doesn't appreciate me. You know, the volatility, the whatever the argument was, and I was hearing more and more arguments between them. And as a kid, you know, you lock yourself away in the room, or you go to your best friend's house. You try and ignore it. And this is, again, where Diana Ross comes in. Because, literally, I would often go to my room, turn up, you know, my record player, the LP on my record player, turn up the sound and dance or sing or listen to the Diana Ross's music. But I think the first sign, and I didn't see it as a sign, but, again, it's when you reflect, when you look back, is, you know, my mother had been very independent, run her own businesses, raised two children before she met my father and had me. And she met my father, and then she's suddenly in a very traditional marriage. And my father was the provider, and he was very proud of that, and no wife of his was going to work. My mother, she never opened up or trusted my father enough to express her feelings and the fact that she wanted to go back to work. Nothing serious, just, you know, a part-time job, really, and nothing that was going to interfere with the family. But, you know, she attempted to do that, and my father told her, no, you are not going to go out and work outside the house. And so it was really, that was probably when I was about 12 or 13, I really began to see and notice changes. But again, you ignore that as a child. You don't want to see that. Hmm. So it did become more and more obvious, I suppose, when I was around 15, because she would have these blow-ups more and more, and the arguments became more and more intense between them.
Right.
There were signs.
You're right. When Dad sent her home that day, it somehow started the domino effect of what was to come. Her plan was thwarted, her spirit crushed, the spring in her step and the lilt in her voice stilled, at least temporarily. So she does make this announcement that she is leaving your father, and then ultimately she does that. And, I mean, much to your amazement, and I appreciate the detail with which you describe this, the experience of coming home at some point, I guess, the next day, and finding that your mother is gone and every trace mm-hmm. of her in your house is also gone. And you thought she was just saying words, but in fact, she was completely serious. Explain to our listeners where your mother went, and part of what made this so difficult for you to both accept and understand.
Yes. I think the first thing I would say there is, you know, you're right, every trace gone. But the worst was, there was no note, there was no number. I just had to really dig deep and realize that she'd gone literally next door. She'd bought the house, and clearly this was part of a strategic plan. She'd bought the house a couple of years earlier. She used to have a house elsewhere in London that she rented out once she met my father. She rented it out and sold that to buy the house next door. And she rented it to these college students. They were all athletes, actually, training to be actually geography and PE teachers, physical education. So literally, you know, it's like they walk out my front door, number 49, turn left, and you walk into the green front door at 47. There was just like this gate between us. It was directly next door. And what makes that hard is that it was like it's shoved in your face. Because not only she'd moved next door and, yes, three hot college guys, but it was like she had dropped us as a family and was now taking care of this new these boys. And I remember saying to her, Mom, you're living with three college boys, let alone, you know, sharing a house with them. You're going to share a bathroom with them. I mean, people didn't have ensuite bathrooms on those days. You know, so this is really confusing to me. And I think that's the word I would use more than anything. It was confusing. It was embarrassing. And it was incredibly awkward. Can you imagine walking out of your house with your father? And remember, she didn't tell my dad she was leaving. Hmm. I had to tell him.
Incredible.
So, convenient, she's next door, yes. But incredibly inconvenient, absolutely, because it was just, I could never run or hide from it. It was always in my face.
Tell us about the occasions when you would visit that house next door, and in particular, the relationship that sprang up between you and these good-looking, athletic college boys who were also living there with your mother. And what exactly was going on, as far as you can tell?
Well, it's interesting because when, we talk about she moved next door with three hot college guys, immediately everyone thinks, oh, was she having an affair with one of them? But you've got to remember, she was 60, 61 by this point, and they're all 20. I'm 16. So a 16-year-old girl is very impressionable. And particularly when she starts to get attention from particularly one of the young men, which I think I can't remember what I call him in the book.
Maybe George?
George? No, George was my boyfriend that broke up
with
me
right
around the time my mum left. Yes.
Yep, I don't remember.
Yeah, and the reason I'm a little confused is because I changed people's names. You have to, so not everyone's, because my family members didn't want their names changed, but you have to get permission to use names. So let's call him Mark for now. It was really fascinating because on one hand, I'm incredibly hurt and confused and rather lost at this, a whole new kind of situation that I'm living in. But on the other hand, it's actually quite fun going next door to Mum, because here is this, two, one of them left after a while, probably couldn't handle Mum. But there's these two college guys, and one of them's paying a lot of attention to me. So there's a lot of flirting going on. And it was quite fun going to Mum's, because also I'm seeing this woman who is my mother, who is like queen of her castle. And she is, you can see how happy she is. So that's also strange, because, I'm now experiencing this much happier woman who's telling these stories, but now she's happier. She's easier to be around. I mean, honestly, as most mothers of a 16-year-old can appreciate, there were a lot of clashes going on between she and I before she left as well. So I hate to say it, it took some of that burden off of the day-to-day altercations that we might be getting. But now I'm getting all this attention. And it's quite fun going next door to Mum's. So that's something that you're also trying to process of, okay, this seems easier because I'm not hearing the arguments between them. But then I'm also the chain of communication, because she's saying stuff to me, he's saying stuff to me, I'm having to communicate. That's where I talk about, I'm like a diplomat between the two of them.
Another image you use, I felt like a battered pawn in a chess game, which I thought was intriguing. And at one point you say something that I think also speaks to what it's like to experience and endure something like this, when you said, and this is, of course, early on when it's still quite raw and painful. You write, I felt scared, confused, and totally unprepared, wanting answers, but also afraid of what those answers might be. And, of course, tied up in that fear is your fear that this abandonment had something to do with you.
Yes. Yes. And, because As you have read in the book, Mum could be quite brutal. I mean, she had this, talk about unfiltered. she could say things that she didn't think how that was going to impact or hurt someone. And this is where I have to go back to the only reason I survived this is because those first 10 years of my life were very solid. I knew my parents were there for me. I knew my parents loved me. So, you know, when she said, I gave up 16 years of my life to raise you, which is very hurtful to a child because you're feeling responsible and like, well, maybe I shouldn't have been born. And, you know, and then she turns around and says, well, maybe you shouldn't have. I could have had my freedom. I could have done more.
Another thing she says to you shortly after leaving you is in a sort of a twisted way to encourage you. She tells you, you're big and ugly enough to take care of yourself, which, I mean, again, is a horrific thing for a mother to say to a daughter or for any parent to say to any child. And yet that is her own twisted way of trying to encourage you. You actually say something that, in a sense, echoes that. In the chapter titled, Do You Know Where You're Going To?, when you write, I truly believe I chose to be born to my mother so that she could toughen me up for the world. Witch or not, she was a force of nature, nurture and torture, who tested us all. And you tell us her departure was your tipping point. What was the tipping point? What happened to you after that tipping point?
I was pretty much a princess growing up. I was my daddy's girl. Mom did everything in the house. I mean, she actually didn't want me to do anything in the house. So it was very jarring. If you can imagine going from a kid that everything's done for you, there's always a meal, you're always put first. I mean, my mother did put me first before she left. And then she's gone. And so the world's a hard place. It really is. And so I have been able to withstand just about anything, you know, and whether we like it or not, we go through ups and downs. Life is not linear. It's messy. There's lots of different roads we can choose. But in experiencing that, my tipping point really was when she left and the way she did it and the fact she didn't tell my father, I went from child to adult very quickly. And having endured that and having to tell my father that my mother had left, I mean, it still chokes me up. See, this strong man who had been your rock, your anchor, crumble for that moment. There's something that is instilled in you and becomes part of you. But it's like nothing can, if I've endured this, nothing can topple me or hurt me as much. I know I can get through. I can get through whatever. Because I've managed to find my way through it. And I've managed to see it for what it is. And I know I can stand on my own two feet, whatever happens. And I think that was the tipping point. I still remember sitting there listening to her as if I'm kind of on the rafters, you know, just watching out of body experience, her telling me that she's leaving, why she's leaving, all the reasons, and really making it about her. I mean, it was very narcissistic the way she had. I mean, and she was a narcissistic personality. I didn't understand that, know what that even meant at that point. And I didn't even work that out until I was in my 40s.
Well, your book, of course,
they have a,
Your book, of course, is the chronicle of slowly coming to a better understanding of who your mother is, of who you are, and of why she did what she did, and of the ways in which, although it certainly was painful for you, was ways in which you learn from that as well. Towards the end of the book, you write this: "Sifting through the memories and the stories forgotten and unknown to me, I have come to a new appreciation for my mother. It occurred to me she had never dwelled in the hardships, the bias, the loss, the heartbreak, and immense trauma that plagued her time and time again. She lived in her version of the moment with her own set of rules, fantasizing, imagining, waiting for the next, with brightly polished images of the past, deflecting any guilt or regret she might have felt. She ebbed and flowed between highs and lows, displaying all of the textbook characteristics of a narcissistic personality. Seriously, she could suck the life out of a room, but she equally could fill it with life. She was as enlightening as she was cruel, but right or wrong, that's what made her the character she was." So my final question, is this, in a sense, you saying that you have forgiven your mother, as that woman a few years ago advised you to try to do? Have you come to the point where you are able to do that?
Absolutely. And the truth is, Greg, I thought I had when that woman in, what, I think it's 2013, said that to me. I thought I had forgiven her. But somewhere in my soul, I clearly still held on to certain memories, pain, and hadn't. But I think forgiveness is a really important part of the story. And I quote in the epilogue, I say how I wouldn't change a thing. And the purpose of forgiveness is to reestablish our humanity. Because forgiveness is something that if we can't do that, the only person we hurt ultimately is ourselves, and if you're a parent, future generations. And I think it's something that, again, it comes down to finding forgiveness is really about finding compassion and understanding, and understanding that these characters are human beings, and you know, our mothers are human, and they're flawed. All of us are flawed. But I suppose, you know, in what you just read, my mother really lived in the present moment. And we hear that term constantly these days, you know, live in the present. But people don't really do that. But I realize she did. And you have to have immense respect for someone who went through what she did in life and still was able to see the light in this world and still was able to see the good and live for that, even though there was, again, terrible darkness at times. But that's the world we live in. So I think forgiveness is key. And it's something we all, you know, we all need to consider. It's forgiveness is something that allows us as an individual to feel and be whole. And I think that's all we can ask of ourselves, is to try and be whole and just walk it through life with our eyes wide open, but without judgment. And that's what forgiveness is.
The book is My Mother Next Door, published by Kohler Books, the author Diane Danvers-Simmons. Thank you so much for giving the world this intriguing, thought-provoking book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. I really enjoyed talking with you. Best wishes.
Really appreciate it, Greg, and I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you, and I appreciate you actually reading the book. So you could ask me some really interesting questions. Thank you.
You're welcome. Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to visiting with Carolyn Friesch, who is the executive director of the United Way of Kenosha County. And on Wednesday, J. Randy Tarabarelli.